Okay, so we next have a talk by Navdeep Jaitley, who is from Jeff Hinton's group. And both Malcolm and I were very excited to get Navdeep to be a part of this session, in part because there's a set of methods that have been widely used over the last 5 to 10 years for doing stuff with images and in machine vision, an assortment of things referred to as deep belief networks. And they haven't really been used in sound very much. And so Jeff's group has very recently, over the past couple of years, been starting to apply these methods to do stuff with audio. And so Navdeep's going to be talking a little bit about this. And these methods are really extensions of things that were kind of initially developed back in the 80s and have really been revived with a set of new training methods in the last 10 years. So Navdeep.
I'd like to thank Josh and Malcolm for giving me a chance to come and present some of this work today. So like Josh mentioned, there's been a lot of development recently in generative models for high-dimensional data. And here's some examples of some of the samples generated from such models. I actually seem to have skipped ahead. Here's some examples of digits generated from the first deep belief network, which was published in 2006. I'd like to point out that these are actually samples from the model rather than reconstructions of particular data cases. So the model's quite powerful, and it has very high peaks at real data points. Here's some samples from a recently published model, which was a gated MRF. And this model was trained on natural image patches. And so you can see this model's really good at modeling both short and long-range correlations in images. Here's an example of motion sequence. So models have also been developed for motion sequences. And in this case, the training data was joint angles from motion capture data. Okay, so it's been seen that features from these generative setups are also very good at discriminative tasks. And that makes sense on an intuitive level. What's good for generating specific types of patterns is probably good at recognizing those patterns. And Josh's talk showed an example of features that were good at generating textures, sound textures, and those could be used for recognizing these textures. These models have been used widely for vision tasks, but they haven't made it quite as much into sound yet. And so for this work, we wanted to see if we could use these models for raw speech signals and see if the features that we learned were useful in a generative setup, in a discrimination task. So our goal specifically is, given raw speech signals, we want to build a generative model for subsequences of these signals of 6.25 milliseconds length. And we were using TIMIT, which is sampled at 16 kilohertz. So we had data vectors which were 100 samples long. And the vector we're actually modeling is a 100-dimensional vector whose entries are the intensities of the raw sound samples. OK, so here's a quick outline of the talk. I'll quickly talk about the RBMs, and then I'll, which are the restricted Boltzmann machines. That's the generative model we use for this paper. Then I'll show some results from the generative model, and I'll talk about the application of the features to phone recognition on TIMIT. Okay, so first I should, I would like to talk about why we wanted to use raw signals themselves. The first reason was that we didn't want to make any assumptions about the signal themselves, such as stationarity of the signal within a single frame. Secondly, we were motivated by speech synthesis. And in that domain, being able to model raw speech signals would allow us eventually to be able to generate realistic signals without having to satisfy phase constraints. We also wanted to be able to discover patterns which and their relative onset times with our model, and we think that should probably be helpful in discriminating between certain phonemes. So the last reason is because we now can, and it sounds a little facetious, but it's probably the most important motivation for using raw signals. Traditional encodings such as MFCCs have been around for quite some time now. Within the same amount of time, computational resources have exploded by at least 1,000 times. At the same time, a lot of data is now available to train really powerful models, and also machine learning has made a lot of progress in being able to pick out features and building really good models from data alone. And so that's why we wanted to try and do this straight on raw signals. Okay, here's a quick outline of restricted Boltzmann machines. So a restricted Boltzmann machine, or an RBM, is an undirected graphical model. And it has two layers of nodes. The bottom one, which is the visible layer, corresponds to the dimensions of the data that's observed. And the top layer is known as, are the hidden variables, and these are basically latent variables that try and explain the data. There's a set of interaction weights connecting these two layers. And the architecture is such that there's bipartite connectivity, which implies that given the visible nodes, all the hidden nodes are independent of each other, and the opposite is true of the visibles when the hidden variables are known. And since it's an undirected graphical model, it's an undirected graphical model, and so there's an energy function associated with any given configuration of the visible and hidden states, and the energy for a given state governs its probability through the Boltzmann distribution. What I was trying to show in this model, in the set of equations here, was the exact equation for a Gaussian binary RBM, which is the RBM that's used for the scenario where we have real valued signals and binary hidden nodes. Now let me see if I can get out of the slideshow. No. Okay. Sorry? Never mind. The equation is not actually that important anyways. So the important point to note about the equation is there's a term in there which looks at the interaction between the configuration of the hidden variables and the visible variables. Okay. Something really interesting about this model is that the priors are quite complicated because they involve a sum of an exponential number of configurations. And the posteriors, on the other hand, are quite simple. So given visible data, the hidden variables are all independent of each other, and they turn on with a probability which is equal to the sigmoid of the input into that hidden node. And the input is essentially the dot product of the visible data and the set of weights connecting a hidden node to the data. So in that sense, this is a very powerful model, and it's different from other generative models where the priors are independent but posteriors are very hard to compute. So the power of this model is that it has very rich priors but very easy posteriors. Okay, so the maximum likelihood estimation of a model such as this is really complicated because the gradient of the log prob is really hard to compute exactly. Fortunately, Jeff Hinton discovered about a decade ago that an algorithm called contrastive divergence could be used to train these models pretty well, and that's the model where that's the algorithm we're using to learn the parameters. One last point about the model we're using: binary hidden units are not very optimal for raw speech signals, and the reason that is that speech patterns can present. Speech signals can have the same pattern over many different orders of magnitude, but binary units can only turn on one output intensity level. And so for this paper, we used an alternative type of a unit called a step sigmoidal unit, and that unit has the property that it can create output intensity at almost any level. And now I won't talk much about those units, but there's more information about that in this paper that's referred here. Okay, here's the experimental setup. Like I said, we were looking at 6.25 milliseconds of speech, and that corresponds to 100 samples. So for each sample, we have a variable in the visible data. So our RBM has 100 visible nodes at the bottom. And we couple that with 120 of the step sigmoidal units in the RBM. The signal itself was selected randomly from the TIMIT database and was presented to the model. Up till on average, the model had seen any sub-segment for about 30 times. Here's some of the features that were learned by the model. On the left side, we see the actual features. And just a reminder, these are just the weights connecting the visible data to the hidden units. So for each hidden unit, we have a pattern. And that hidden unit turns on optimally when the data presents this particular pattern associated with it. So you can see there's a lot of different types of patterns that are learned. Let me go through a few of them very quickly. Here's a pattern that's learned to pick out really low frequencies, maybe like F0 formant or something, or pitch. Here's some patterns that pick up, here's some features that pick up patterns which are slightly higher frequency. And then here's others that are intermediate level frequencies. And then some that are really high frequencies. But there's some other really interesting ones, which are these patterns that seem to have composite frequency characteristics. There's a low frequency component and a high frequency component. And we think that these might be picking up fricatives. OK. So now that we've learned the model, we can reconstruct signals from the posterior activities of the hidden units themselves. So if you take 10 frames of signal and we project the signal into the hidden units, I'm showing the activities of the hidden units here in log scale. And I've only shown 20 of the 120 units that we actually trained. And you can then take these posterior activities of the hidden units and project them back to visible space to reconstruct the raw signal themselves. This is similar in flavor to the previous talk, except we're using a parametric model to do this. Okay, if you look at a reconstruction on a much larger scale, this is 625 milliseconds of raw signal. And you can see in the heat map, the patterns present a high dimensional pattern in the heat map themselves. Here's some samples from the model itself. There's 16 samples. In these samples, 5 of them are quite similar to the others, but they're different from the other 11. Issues. So I think we have a pretty good model for at least small scale signals. So I'm going to switch now to the application of these features to phone recognition. And so the setup that we have is we have 125 milliseconds of raw speech, and we want to be able to use the features that we learned to predict the phoneme labels that we got from a baseline model. So we use the features that we learned to encode this raw signal, and I'll talk about how we did that in the next slide. And then we took the encoded features and put them in the neural network and used backpropagation to learn the mapping to the phoneme labels. Here's a setup of how we did the encoding. So we used a convolutional setup here. And the way it works is we first set the first frame at the first sample of an utterance, and we compute the posterior means. We then move it by one sample, and we do this computation again. And we then do this for the entire utterance. And so we're aiming for high dimensional data, but this is a little too high dimensional because we've essentially multiplied the signal by 120 times. So what we now do is we subsample these hidden units so that we subsample each feature for 25 milliseconds of signal. And the subsampling helps in smoothing out the signal as well. Okay, I have to point out that convolutional setups have been quite useful in vision tasks, and I think our results suggest that it's the same for this setup. Okay, so we have a subsampled frame for 25 milliseconds. We then advance it by 10 milliseconds, and we do this for the entire utterance as well. So for any given speech of 125 milliseconds, we take the 11 frames that span that signal, and we concatenate all of that into one vector, and that's the encoding that's put into the neural network. Okay, sorry, having some issues. The features were first log transformed after we created the entire set of features, and we also added delta and accelerations of the vectors to the encoding. Here's a little bit about the baseline HMM, baseline model. It was just an HMM trained on MFCCs. There were 61 phoneme classes with three states for each class, and we used a bigram language model. Forced alignment to the test data and the training data was used to generate the labels. So we used a standard method for decoding the posterior probabilities, just similar to what's done in tandem-like approaches, and these convert posterior probability predictions to generative probabilities, which can then be decoded with the Turbi decoding. Okay, here's a summary of the results for different configurations of our setup. We used for this set of experiments two hidden layer neural network, and what we found was if we used more hidden units in the neural network, then we got better results. We found that if we used shorter sampling windows and acceleration shifting windows, then we got better results as well. Also, adding the delta and acceleration parameters helped as well. We found that with 120 hidden units, we got the best results. So we combined all these four lessons and trained one neural network with two layers with 4,000 units in each layer. And we used delta and acceleration parameters, and we used a subsampling window of 10 milliseconds with an advance of 5 milliseconds and 120 hidden units in the RBM. So with that, we got 22.8% on the test data set for the phoneme error rate on TIMIT. And then we took it to a four-layer neural network, and with some DBN pre-training, we were able to further reduce it down to 21.83. Okay, so here's the conclusions. The speech signal talks. Machine learning can discover meaningful features from data alone. And I think further work in looking for high-dimensional encodings is justified. And for future work, we aim to build better generative models using multiple layers. And with that, here's the acknowledgments. And I'll open the floor to any questions.
Yeah, question?
Hi, so I enjoy your talk. I had a question. One of the reasons why people shy away in speech from time domain features is the high sensitivity to noise, as opposed to just the raw being raw or not. So how are you going to address that?
I think my answer to that is we just need enough data, and eventually we'll be able to figure that out.
But that's key, because I mean, noise comes in all different forms. You have pink noise, you have white, you have car noise. I mean, if it's just a matter of data, you know, we could have solved the recognition problem if it's just that, but it's more than that.
So I think it's not just the data, it's models that go with the data. And so if you use some of these powerful generative models and try and build in further assumptions about the characteristics of noise, then hopefully you will learn to pick out noise and separate that from real signal. So in the case of the features we learned, if you actually look at the types of features we learned to ignore sort of high frequency components. And so if you look at the reconstruction of signal here, you'll find that some of the aspects of the fricatives were suppressed in the reconstruction. So it's learning to pick out more of the vocal tract information than it's trying to capture noise. And in a sense, that's also its weakness, but the point is that it's able to try and separate out what's noise from what's not.
So adding to Abir's earlier question, not only because of waveform feature is sensitive to noise, but also more importantly, it's sensitive to the magnitude variation. So you're pretty lucky because Timid doesn't have that problem. If you try, have you tried another task that may have? Because about 15 years ago, there have been some recent papers published on using waveform, using other regressive model in the hidden Markov, the hidden filter model to do recognition, which actually seems to may have even better than this RVM. And because of this variation actually sort of make things very difficult. I just wonder whether you actually try some other, maybe you can vary the power, from different file to file to see whether it picked up.
Right, so we actually didn't try any noisy data for this setup, but I'm an advocate of multiple layers of representations, and the hope is that when you build sort of deeper models where lower models try to pick up signals and higher models try to look for more abstract patterns, when you do that, higher level features will try and suppress the noise and separate the signals. But for now, we don't really have any experiments to back that claim.
All right, one more real quick.
I guess one is an observation. I feel like 20 years ago I saw stuff on using neural nets to recognize phonemes, and so I am curious what really the change is, because the other thing that I think about with that is scaling issues. When I think about digit recognition or anything recognition, if all I have to do is make them something sufficiently slower or lower or higher, and I can usually destroy a neural net based on what it had been trained before. And I'm wondering, is this some sort of advancement? Have you gotten around issues with scaling and transformations in space?
Right. So I think what's different from 20 years ago is that these sort of generative models have made a lot of progress, and it's been seen that you can use them to seed neural networks and get much better results than you could from neural networks before. And the amount of data that's now available is much larger than about 20 years ago. So that's sort of to answer the question of what's different from the last 20 years. In terms of scale of the data, I think the kind of units we were using are sort of scale invariant, at least in terms of intensity, and that was the motivation for using them. But they're not, the time aspect is not well covered, and we're actually looking at models to try and sort of be invariant to that aspect of it. I'd like to mention that convolutional networks have been useful in vision-related tasks, and I think they have the potential for adjusting for scales, and we're going to try and see if those would work for
processing. Okay, one last comment.
What's your definition of raw data, and would this approach work for cooked data, whatever that is?
Sorry,
what's
for
your
what
definition
data?
For raw data? What's your own definition of raw data? And would this work for cooked data?
What is cooked data? I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. I think for this paper, the definition was the rawest form that you could capture from the instrument. So we didn't want to make any assumptions that if you take spectral information, that there were assumptions that the signal was stationary between within a single frame, which I think is probably not a very correct information, and probably harms detection of certain types of phonemes. So the second answer to that question is it's just a matter of convenience. It depends on whatever the input was to our system. That's raw data. But so that's the first definition, which was as close as you can get to the capture device.
Okay, we need to move on. Thanks.